I have really fond memories of the movie The Great Escape, the one with Steve McQueen and James Garner and Richard Attenborough. If you've never seen it, it's about a bunch of Allied prisoners of war who are in a German POW camp that was supposed to be escape-proof. The POWs hatch an ingenious plan to escape through a series of tunnels. The Great Escape is based on a true story, and the characters are loosely based on the men who are actually there. The Steve McQueen character was based, to a degree, on a man called John Williams, who wasn't American. John Williams was an Australian Air Force officer. Louise Williams is my guest today, and John Williams was her uncle. But John never came home. And what happened to him after he escaped from Stalag Luft No. 3 was something of a mystery. Then in 2011, the Williams family received an email, just out of the blue, from a man in the Czech Republic who had some answers for them. Louise Williams is a former journalist and a foreign correspondent, so she simply had to write her uncle's story. And what a story it is. Her book is called A True Story of the Great Escape, a young Australian POW in the most audacious breakout of World War II. Hello, Louise.
Hi.
Look at that picture of him. That picture of him. He's such a good-looking guy. He was dashing, natty and well-dressed, but really he's a surfy from Manly, isn't he?
Well, yeah, via New Zealand. Born in New Zealand, came to Australia when he was 10, and washed up in Manly in the Depression, like lots of families, boarding house, five kids, all the boys on the veranda. And, wow, what a paradise that was, because they were, you know, they could smell the salt from the veranda two doors down from the corner, southern corner of Manly Beach, nice and sheltered. And that was, you know, where you could run free when the rest of the world was really kind of going to pot. So it was fantastic.
And this is the part of Sydney you grew up in too, isn't it, around
that
area?
Yeah, around that area. And I actually, after, you know, several overseas postings and, you know, travelling all over Asia as a correspondent, it's actually where I've come back to. So I live there now.
Now, was John Williams spoken of around the house or around the family when you were a kid?
Yeah, absolutely. My dad was 10 years younger, you know, he was the one at home with as the brothers one by one went off to war, and he's the only one that was too young to actually serve. And, you know, there was always this kind of legend of Uncle John, and you know, with an enormous amount of sadness, but also with a huge, you know, almost a reverence for what he'd actually managed to do. And you know, right back to, you know, having one of these huge wooden surfboards and managing to learn to surf and being in the surf boats in the surf club and actually being in everything, you know.
And was his name linked with the Great Escape in your childhood?
Of course. Yes. Yeah. You know, my dad was a kind of a modest, self-effacing guy. I think they just turned the volume down as they went through the kids because there were so many of them that he was sort of like quietly watching in the corner. And he used to just say sort of, you know, as a sort of side, you know, your uncle was a leader of the Great Escape, you know, your uncle was a, you know, Australian surfing champion. And we, you know, there was the 60s and 70s. Who cared about the war?
Right, you just didn't really make much of a dent in your psyche beyond a certain point then.
Not really, because, you know, we had parents who lived through World War II, grandparents who lived through World War II and World War I. So the war. Come on, you know, 60s and 70s, the world is changing. And we didn't like Vietnam, so we didn't like war. We didn't really get it, I don't think.
Now after the war, the death of the escapees was seen as a great crime and they were going to get to the bottom of it, but they never did when it came to your uncle, John. Did your dad ever try and find out for himself what had happened to his brother?
Yeah, he always wanted to, and my parents did finally make that, you know, great big journey to Europe. It was, you know, it was kind of a hard thing, and you need lots of money, relatively speaking, you know, back in the 80s. And he made some inquiries in London, and my younger brother remembers going up to sort of inquiry counters with him. I didn't go on the trip. And basically just, you know, with a name like John Williams before computerized records, could have been anyone, couldn't he?
Right.
And bear in mind that after the end of the war, the borders changed, the former camp fell into ruins, and then ended up in Poland because they moved the border, and the graves are also in Poland. So
went behind the Iron Curtain.
Yeah, then. Went very much behind the Iron Curtain. So, you know, we didn't have this sort of great advantage of sort of international digital communication, and had geopolitics in the way.
So the question of what happened to him then, just, well, in your dad's mind anyway, just hung in the air then for a
while.
Well,
look, he knew that he had been one of the 50 that were, you know, chosen for the execution, and they seemed to think, the family seemed to think that, you know, the perpetrators had been brought to justice, because it was an enormous show trial after the war, because the Allied, the Air Force was just so outraged at the brazen manner in which these smart, talented guys were executed, that they were determined to, you know, no stone would be unturned. But this case actually wasn't solved.
So your dad passed away some years ago. Then in 2011, right out of the blue, like I said, your family gets an email. Tell me about the man who sent the email and what was in that message.
Well, firstly, we only got it by accident, because my youngest brother happened to have sort of stumbled across a Facebook group, you know, to do with the Great Escape, and that's how this Czech commercial pilot found us. So essentially, Mikhail Holy, who's now a great friend of ours, he's a Czech commercial pilot, great interest in military aviation history. He jokes that his mother-in-law's house is on the way to the camp, so he used to drop his wife and kids off there and go and do his research in Poland in the camp.
Wow.
And in the area that he comes from, there's planes everywhere still, because there was this thing called the Battle of All Mountains, where planes were literally just sort of falling out of the sky towards the end of the war. And the American servicemen that actually survived that battle went to Stavag Luft 3. He thought, oh, I'll go and, you know, a bit of local history. There's, you know, involved in the museum. And then he discovered the fact that a group of the great escapers had actually made it into Czechoslovakia and had been last seen in the Gestapo headquarters in a town called Reichenberg, and later had been delivered, unfortunately, after their execution to the crematorium in a little town called Most.
And what did he have for you then?
He had shuffled around in the National Archives, and from a manila folder out fell this original Gestapo document ordering the men's cremations, and it was signed and dated the day before they were actually killed, which was overwhelming evidence of the premeditation of the murders, despite the fact that the Nazis had gone to great lengths to pretend that all these guys had been shot while trying to escape. For what reason, we don't know. They just liked to have their, you know, records in order or something like that. Everyone knew that.
But yeah, they'd normalised the crimes, didn't
they? Yes. So, but they'd created this ridiculous paper trail to try and claim they were shot while trying to escape. And here was this stunning document that had somehow been sitting in the archives in Prague. And that was really the beginning of not just my investigation, but this whole web of new relationships with other families touched by this story.
And you must have wondered, why has this man, this lovely man, this Czech pilot, Mikhail, taken such an interest in this incident?
Well, I guess that, you know, it's a sort of a long and a short story. The short story is that he thought that, you know, this was something that had never been acknowledged, and these poor guys had, you know, from the other side of the world had died, and no one had ever acknowledged it. There was no memorial. That's, you know, that part of the story. But the other part of the story, I think, was that his family were refugees from a communist regime. They'd walked out of Czechoslovakia with nothing. And when the Iron Curtain did fall, they'd come back. So what had happened under you know, the Soviet bloc, was anyone that had any association with the West had been, of course, demonised. So anyone who'd served with the RAF or any of the you know, the Allied pilots who died in that territory had been completely forgotten. So there was a sort of interesting geopolitical process occurring where people could actually now recover the history that lost under that blanket of Soviet rule.
And those links between the Allies and Western Allies and Czech fighters and Czech pilots and all that
could be revived. Because a lot of the Czech pilots who flew for the RAF, they were ended up jailed as traitors. And some of them were executed. The same with the Poles, as if they hadn't suffered enough.
Let's follow the life of your uncle now then. Like we say, he begins in Manly, poor family, surfing is his pleasure. How does he make his own surfboards?
Well, funnily enough, his old surfing buddy turned out to still be alive. Again, it's a little bit of a side diversion, but he was a German-born guy. And he's still alive now. He's close to 100. So he was able to tell me about how you had to order a slab of timber from some timber mill and drag it onto the ferry and shape it. How, I don't know. But also, he had a little old car, his friend, and they had to carve out some roof racks. So there was this amazing story about, John was a medical student, but, you know, his absolute passion was surfing. And this required some skills. You didn't just go down to Bennett Boards or, you know, and get you something because someone else had shaped it. You had to make it yourself or shape it yourself, and they weighed a ton, and then to transport it around. Added to that, his German friend used to help him practice his school German, which again became part of the story of The Great Escape.
So what attracted him to become a flyer and join the RAF rather than the RAAF?
Oh, look, I think it's hard to know. And when you're looking at a story as amazing as this and trying to understand who were these men that were so motivated and disciplined and smart that managed to dig a tunnel 100 metres long in sand and get out, and you kind of look back at their lives. And I guess part of it was he was highly motivated and he was very skilled and smart, obviously. I think partly his motivation was that my family had been fairly well-to-do in Wellington and lost all their money in the Depression, so they went from the big house with the house help to the boarding house. So perhaps, I don't know. And he was someone who desperately wanted to prove himself. So he'd probably seen, you know, our grandfather lose everything. And he saw an ad in the paper and there were four positions only. He'd done, maths and science. He'd got into medicine and he was, you know, surfing surf boats. This was for people who would be doing extreme sports these days. He used to climb cliffs. You know, I guess he's just one of those guys.
See, my old man joined the RAAF, and he said he joined because it was the real glamour of the services. It was about technology, and there was something a bit old-fashioned. It was seen this way. I mean, how true this is, you know, it's another thing. Old-fashioned and almost chivalric, if you like. It's a bit like knights in tournaments. They were, you know, they'd be fighting in planes against one another. There was a sense of glamour and style about the RAAF during the war that made it really stand out amongst the services. I wonder if that was part of the appeal.
I'm not sure, but that's certainly the case, that there was this mythology that this was a return to this, you know, this incredible chivalry and kind of courage of the duel, because you are alone in that plane, pitted against another man. You're not going into battle led by a king or somebody with experience. This was an entirely new form of warfare on which the entire, you know, war would end up turning. And so there were these single men. And in a funny way, they coped with fear better than a lot of the bombers, because they felt that they were in control of their own fate, even though they had to fly, shoot guns and drop bombs, because Kitty Hawks were bomber fighters, at the same time.
Yeah, and get the plane going again once it's stalled and got it
exactly,
went into a tailspin.
Exactly, it's falling, in the air.
Plummeting, yes. I don't know if I'd be too crash hot of that myself, but I'm always a bit in awe of that whole thing. So he gets trained as a pilot and he becomes an instructor pretty quickly. How did he feel about that? Was he happy to be doing that in England, in Britain, I should say, or did he, was he really keen to be part of, be up front and as part of the war effort?
Well, look, I think that anybody who hasn't seen active service wants to rush off to the front line. And, you know, he had no more experience than a rugby brawl of what it was really going to be like. And, of course, anyone who's actually seen war never wants to see it again. So he was 19. He was picked out. He was a very talented flyer. He sort of felt almost winded by the RAF. He'd come with this sort of great colonial chip on his shoulder to the mother country, looking for this elusive great, you know, British gentleman who was apparently this, you know, fabulous personage, to discover that they were all a bunch of Philistines and they had no respect for the colonials or the dominions, as they called them.
Oh, really?
Then.
He said that in his letters?
Absolutely.
Right. So he was irritated by the snobs?
Well, he was sort of, kind of put down, and he had to teach them as well. So not only did he miss out on going to the front line, all his expectations have been turned on their head. And
he's teaching a bunch of Hooray Henrys then, is he?
That's what he said. And, that's what his letters home said, which were quite funny, actually, because he did have very good sense of humour.
Eventually he then gets posted to North Africa,
yes,
where he's made a squadron leader in the RAAF, just before the Battle of El Alamein.
Yeah.
Now, there's a description there of the Australian flyers wearing Italian uniforms. What was all that about?
Well, look, the Australians certainly had a reputation for going decidedly off-piste, which is hardly the expression for the desert, but anyway, being rather casual when it came to uniform. And it was part of, I guess, their sense of humour, because you know, these days we can get a nice sort of animated BBC graphic that shows the forces pushing back and forth across the north of Africa in successive waves. You know, the Allies push forward and then the Axis forces push back. So they're constantly overrunning each other's camps. And the Italians had these beautiful uniforms, all gold braided and camembert, and and pasta and all sorts of stuff. The Australians
what, in
just
North Africa?
Thought it was really funny, they're a bunch of rat bags, according to the RAF. But they soon discovered that they're also very loyal and pretty good flyers.
There's a really fantastic description in your book. You quoted from the great Australian journalist Alan Moorhead, who was kind of like our Hemingway in a way.
Yeah, he was amazing.
He described the Australian flyers in North Africa. I'd love you to read that, please, Louise.
Yep. They lived sharp, vivid lives. Their response to everything, women, flying, drinking, working, was immediate, positive and direct. They ate and slept well. There was little subtlety and even less artistry about what they did and said and thought. They had no time for leisure, no opportunity for introspection. They made friends easily, and never again after the speed and excitement of this war would they lead the lives that they had once been designed to lead. They were no material for peace.
Mm. There's a kind of hidden doom in that, isn't there?
Yeah, and, anybody who knows even the slightest bit about World War II knows that the chance of coming back from a tour as a fighter pilot or a bomber pilot was pretty much about, one in two.
Tell me what happened to John on that day, a fateful day, on October the 31st, 1942, when he was sent out with a group of other flyers. And
well, he wasn't even sent out. He was a squadron leader, so he led them
out.
So,
beg your pardon. Right.
So, the Battle of El Alamein was almost won. This was the turning point. The Allies virtually had control of North Africa finally, and they were going on a long-distance reconnaissance mission. They were way behind enemy lines. There were four of them. One turned back with engine trouble. And they were swooping down as they did, ack-acking the whatever infrastructure on the ground. And next thing John knew, his number two, whose position was to watch the back of the squadron leader, was actually coming straight at him. I don't know how or why that happened.
What did he fall out of formation or something?
Yeah, I guess so. And he opened fire on his squadron leader.
So why?
He shot John down.
Why?
By mistake.
By mistake.
Out of fear, out of, and the poor guy, his name is in some of the histories and there's no need to bring it up, but what happened then was they immediately transferred out of the unit and he then died. He was shot down and killed.
Oh, poor.
So it was probably pilot error. They're pumping these guys through the training. You know, it might have started off with you got a whole, 6 months or whatever. By the end, you're getting a couple of weeks and go fly the thing. You know, they really needed pilots. So John's so far away that he couldn't possibly be rescued. And it was also...
So how did he get to the ground once he was shot, once the plane was shot up?
Just the same way that anybody else did, glide it down.
Oh, he didn't parachute out.
He actually brought the plane down. Yeah. So
there he was in the middle of the desert, in other words.
Yeah, he was in the middle of the desert. He was seen to get out of his plane uninjured, But it was very hard to pick pilots up, particularly as you couldn't fit two in a single seat plane. To do that, you had to both take your parachutes off. And it had been done, but it was too far away. So he was essentially left in the desert. He was a long way away.
So he must, we surmise then he was just picked up by some German patrol unit then.
Yeah, actually, I think the Italians had that, and they had a very ironically named Palms of Benghazi, little local POW camp, as you can imagine, running with raw sewage, et cetera, et cetera. But fortunately, in a way, for John, the flyers were all sent to Germany because they were thought to be very valuable. And there was this sort of, I guess, almost, it's almost like a kind of naive and, passe respect that still existed between the two air forces. It was, as you say, the great new technology, the great modernity, and there was this idea that somehow there was a respect between the forces. So the RAF and RAAF officers were treated vaguely, much better than foot soldiers, and they were sent to Germany for a special debriefing, and then off to a special camp.
So they were taken to this special camp, Stalag Luft number 3.
Yeah.
Paint me a picture of this camp, please.
Well, look, I've been there several times now, which is three times actually.
What's it like?
Look, funnily enough, it actually looks a bit like it does on the film with The Great Escape, all these...
What, like Colditz or something
like
that?
No, not quite, but, all these, surrounded by pine trees to the point that you can't see anything, so it's very claustrophobic. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
You've got no sort of sense of the horizon. There's a replica hut of the hut, all freshly sawn pine that still smells like it would have smelled because it was a new camp. There's even a little fake bit of the tunnel. So it's flat, it's bleak, the sky's grey, and you can't see beyond the trees.
Now, here's the thing. It was said to be escape-proof. And, I'm getting pictures here of Hogan's Heroes. No prisoner has escaped from Starlake 13. They're going to... How was that figured? How could they make that boast that it was escape-proof? I mean, what was there to keep the prisoners in?
Tons of guards for a start, and all these, all these stooges and rubbernecks, as they used to call them, spying on them the whole time. But they had, a little bit of technology. They had microphones that were in the surface that were meant to pick up tunnelling, so they had to go very deep to get a tunnel beyond the range of the microphones. They had double fences, they had a kill zone, so they had a kind of double fence and
a line. Oh, like a no-man's land, you mean?
Yeah, a no-man's land, and so you were given a warning to retreat, and if you didn't, you'd be shot, all of that stuff. And thank goodness they built the huts of double wood, so they had plenty of wood that they could secret away to use in the tunnel without the Germans noticing.
Now, once John got there to the prison camp, was there much for him to do at first?
Look, I think the biggest challenge of a POW camp, from all the oral histories that I've listened to and all the letters I've read, is to stay psychologically resilient. So to do that, bear in mind that they'd sort of corralled all of the Allied Air Force officers into this one camp. And at the time, to be an Air Force officer, you had to be pretty smart and you had to be pretty skilled. So they sort of put all the best minds together in this camp.
In a camp they called Escape
Roof. Yeah, and they
soon... that's a red rag to a bull, isn't it?
Yeah, and they soon figured out that what they call bed bashing, lying around in your hut feeling sorry for yourself all day, was really a very dangerous thing for depression. So they made these diaries. So you can imagine, Oh, splendid. I'd like to play cricket on Friday. I must check my diary. I mean, it's actually really quite funny. And they, they came up with sports programs, and they actually ended up setting up a university because, a lot of them could teach stuff. So they created this very sophisticated buzz of activity. They had Fudaco, which was a food and tobacco trading system, to make sure that the Red Cross parcels were properly distributed. And then beneath this was the X organisation, which was the secret organisation of the really you know, diehard escapees, and there was a ballot to see who could get in. And they had 600 people working on three tunnels beneath this phenomenal creative buzz of sports games and cooking and learning and jokes and taking a turn around the perimeter and all of these funny things. Ice skating. They set up an ice skating. They set up an ice skating rink. They had swimming in the fire hydrant pool. So they also had this incredible sense of humour. And they even had a theatre. And apparently they used to say, we had everything in the camp except women. So they had to have some characters in drag for their plays. So, yeah, so look, in itself was this amazing little world, hemmed in as it was, sort of both physically and psychologically by the trees.
So John's in the prison camp. They're organising an escape. There's a secret escape committee, and his friend, one of his best friends, Rusty Kierath, shows up in the same prisoner of war camp. That must have been an amazing day for him.
Yeah, look, they had this. I guess it was a tradition of when there was a new group arriving from the interrogation centre, because they used to debrief them with all sorts of, you know, interesting psychological techniques before they came to the camp to try and get information. So they'd all wait at the gate to see if they knew, had a friend in any of the new arrivals. And it was a great day for John when Rusty showed up, because he and Rusty actually went back to school days. They'd actually both played rugby together. They were a few years apart at school, but John had been in the seconds when second rugby 15s or whatever they're called, when Rusty was in the first. So they'd trained together, and then they'd met up again in first in Rhodesia in training, and then in North Africa. So they'd actually become very close friends.
Right.
So they'd known each other since they were teenagers. And you know, I think that, you know, there's the camaraderie of a shared trauma, but I tell you what, if you've got someone from home that is going to endure that trauma with you, you quickly, as he did, arrange for them to share your bunk room, move in with you, join in with the various activities. And we're fortunate to have now great contacts with the Kierath family, and I had access to also to Rusty's full set of letters home, which just a delightful reading, which sounds funny, but, you know, all this warmth he's exuding for his mum and telling his mum about how to make a creaky POW cake out of the rations, and just the, you know, I guess that kind of emotional, I just imagine these sort of emotional ties across the world that these letters represented. So Rusty is this beautiful guy who's, you know, also there, who's also, you know, really, really missing Australia, wants to go home, and so joins the escape group under the guise of being one of the sporting organisers, because the way they used to organise things was initially in they used to list people's names under sports matches, which were actually the digging and the various other activities rosters, and then they got so many that the sports list couldn't possibly hold them, so then they moved them into the education office, and ironically the guys that were assigned to to listen to the German guards and try and spy on them, they were listed under the German classes, when in fact they could all speak German. Okay.
So there's this hive of activity going on, you're saying, education, sport, keep the chaps busy, but it's a kind of a smokescreen in a way.
The
secret escape committee being run by RAF squadron leader Roger Bushell.
Yeah.
Now, the plan was to dig three tunnels that they named Tom, Dick and Harry,
of course.
Why three?
Well, it was quite the ingenious plan, because they figured that, you know, if one got found, the Germans would think, oh, well, we've found it, great, these guys are going to be, you know, very, very downheartened and will all just sort of curl up in their bunks. If they find two, they'll think, oh, my goodness, this must be it. And they wouldn't even consider there might be a third one.
That makes sense in a kind of way, doesn't it?
So it was sort of like kind of an insurance policy. And, of course, Harry, the one that was finally the escape route, was the most difficult and the longest and the hardest to build.
What was the process of digging and building these tunnels like, Louise?
oh, horrendous. You know, I mean, these, firstly, you know, if you haven't seen the movie, the entry to Tunnel Harry was actually under a stove that was on. So they had to dig out through a kind of foundation block down. It's 10 metres down. It's sandy soil. They had to engineer perfectly, which was John's job, who's head of the carpentry department, the wooden shoring so it would clip in before the tunnel collapsed. And they had these sort of ingenious kind of wooden paddles that they lifted the stove up, moved it to the side, the guys went down, they put the stove back over, and they had to make sure that they were never seen.
Brilliant, like a burning stove.
Yeah, a burning stove.
So why would you even think that the escape hatch would be under that?
A burning stove. So, and then, you know, in the tunnel, you know, there's the sort of Hollywood version, which is, you know, kind of, I guess, looks a little bit clean. The real version was, you know, the tunnel was, the guys had to piss in there and, you know, yeah. And they say worse sometimes, and the caved in on them. They had to be pulled out by their feet, and they had to get all the sand off and get back into their POW clothes without being seen. So they had quite a sophisticated roster shift, and only people who really weren't claustrophobic could dig it, because it was only as wide as a man's shoulders. It's not like
It's only that big.
It's that big. And the carpentry team, they actually devised, which again was what John ran, a wooden railway system where they had a flat platform that they pulled along wooden rails, and that was a really good way of getting people backwards and forwards.
And those scenes in the movie where they scatter the excavated, you know, earth and sand through the puffed up trouser legs. Is that true?
Absolutely true. That's the funny thing, is that the movie had composite characters, so not apart from, you know, the Roger Bushell one, no one was really recognisable. But a lot of the details were, you know, like the penguins, so they used to, you know, put the soil down the legs of the trousers and then discreetly walk around the camp and scatter it. All of that stuff, that's actually all true.
It was completed.
Yes.
And then, of course, the time comes to hand out positions on who's going to escape and what order. How was all that done?
Part of it was a ballot, but the earlier positions, which John and Rusty filled, that was based on who'd played a very significant role and done a lot of work. So they got positions possibly 31 and 32, could have been 32 and 33. That's the thing about memory, you know, there's so many records of this, but they don't all agree. And so that was actually considered. There were 200 spots. For the 600 people who worked on it, only 200 could go. And the idea was to really create the biggest hue and cry ever to get 200 guys out and to really, disrupt things at a time in the war where that would have been pretty psychologically damaging to the Germans, because the war was actually turning against them.
What happened on the night of the escape? They waited for a moonless night, of course.
Yes.
What happened on the night of the escape?
Well, it was bloody freezing. It was this incredibly, incredibly unseasonably cold March. So there was snow on the ground. And they, you know, had their last Kriegi supper. They had their high energy rations, all of that stuff. They're fabulous, you know, disguises made out of uniforms to make them look like workers. And Leslie Bull, who was actually in John's group in the end, he went through first and pushed open the hatch, and they discovered the tunnel had come up short. They were actually in sight of one of the guard towers. They weren't in the trees. So they had to come up with a new solution. What Leslie Bull did was he worked out a way of rigged up a string. He then hid in the trees, and he pulled on the string each time the searchlight panned away from the exit so they could rush out. But the other thing they hadn't thought of was all of these you know, young men all in their winter coats in the tunnel. It was absolutely boiling, waiting for it to come out. It was winter. There was steam coming out the hatch as well. So that was going to be a dead giveaway if anyone noticed that there was a hole in the which would have been funny if it wasn't so tragic.
And just quietly, I'm getting a claustrophobic shudder here because I'm just thinking of being wedged into a tunnel, waiting in a tunnel no bigger than wider than my shoulders in a greatcoat for, I don't know,
a
half an hour,
time.
An hour, two
a
hours.
Time. A long time.
A long time. And so John made his escape successfully out of that hole with Rusty and two other men.
About midnight, which meant he would have been in the tunnel for about 2 hours.
What happened when they popped out?
Well, there was a group of 12 of them. He was the leader of that group. And in the movie, they sort of head straight for the main railway station. So the cameras, imagine the cameras heading off with Steve McQueen and the gang that way. Our group of 12, they were disguised as workers from, some sort of woodyard. They walked quite a long way to a tiny little station, one of the ones off the beaten track, and caught a local train.
Well, they would have had to buy tickets.
Did any
speak German? I mean,
yes, they had.
It'd have to be flawless German, wouldn't
yes,
it?
Yes, absolutely. They had Jerzy Monschein, who was Polish and whose family I've since met. He managed to get them 12 tickets. And, some of the records describe them in the little waiting station like a draped around like a pirate crew looking so crusty and so crusty that the local farmer and his wife didn't want to sit in there with them waiting for the train at 6 a.m. in the morning. But they got on and they got on okay. And they took a train heading towards the Czechoslovakian border. And there was one terrifying moment. They're all sitting there in this, wooden seats, probably third class, and a great big female conductress comes marching down the aisle shouting at them, and they think, the game's up. And, of course, it's Rusty, he's smoking, and they're in a non-smoking carriage. So the moment passes, and they actually get to the base of the mountains that divide Germany from then Czechoslovakia, which was, of course, Nazi-occupied as well.
What happened when they got to the border then?
They got there, and it was absolutely freezing, snowing, and 8 out of the 12 decided that they'd actually try to get on another train because they had fake identification, they had money, they had some German skills, and they'd made it this far, wow, that actually, they had no idea the alarm had been sounded or anything like that. They had no idea what was going on. But our guys, John and Rusty, and then Leslie Bull, who had a young son who was number one out of the tunnel, and Jerzy Monschein, the Pole, he also had a daughter back in Poland. They just set off in two separate pairs. They decided to walk, and the snow was in some places waist deep, and it's way before Gore-Tex, so they were bloody cold.
And what happened to those men who decided to catch the train instead?
They were arrested at the next station.
Had the alarm gone out by then?
The alarm had gone out.
How many had escaped? Was it 200? 76 had escaped.
76 had got out. And that group of 8, one of them, Jimmy James, survived from that group. And I was fortunate enough to talk to him at length before he died. So I did, in the years leading up to this book research, I did get to talk to Jimmy a couple of times. He'd been in John's group. So they were not so lucky. They were picked up and thrown into various cells. But John and Rusty were walking through the snow.
Walking through the snow. So while he set out on foot, the alarm has gone out. How did Adolf Hitler react when he was given the news that more than 70 men had escaped from the inescapable POW camp?
Well, I guess like any dictator, he takes everything personally. I mean, dictators aren't, really known for rational thought. So he was enraged. He was raging. And he wanted them all shot. And the funny thing was, well, it's not really funny, but, the strange thing was that this war was sort of being played out as though the Geneva Convention actually, meant something. So the Germans wanted to appear to be doing the right thing. So
there was an argument between him,
yes,
and Hermann Göring, who's the head, yes, of the Luftwaffe, and Heinrich Himmler,
yes,
the head of the SS. What happened? How did that argument unfold?
There was a very big argument, and in the end, it was, which I can't remember which one, Göring, I think it was, was trying to talk him down. And, of course, these were airmen. So Goring had, you know, had great respect for the Allied airmen in
And I suppose, of course, if they shoot Allied airmen, then he's worried that the Allies are going to reciprocate.
Absolutely. And also remember that this was the time in you know, of the massive bombing of Germany. So German civilians are really feeling the RAF's wrath.
But Hitler wanted them all shot,
yes.
Or everyone that was caught to be shot.
Yes, absolutely.
So what happened? How did he climb down from that position?
His compromised position was 50. Okay, we'll shoot 50. So they created this dreadful system where they put all the prisoners' cards as they were recaptured in different piles. One was the shoot pile and one was the pile to send them off to a concentration camp.
So John, meanwhile, has gone walking into the snow to try and cross the Czech border by foot with his three friends.
Yeah, initially they were separate, but apparently they joined up again. There were two pairs, but they came together because, I guess psychologically it's much better to be in a four in such a miserable situation.
Do we know how they were caught?
Yep, they were caught by a ski patrol, which is, you know, really unfortunate because they did make it into Czechoslovakia. And they ended up being thrown into the Gestapo cells in a town called Liberec. And I've actually seen the building, which is sort of really weird because it's a bank now.
So there were more than 70 POWs that had been caught. Hitler insisted that 50 needed to be executed.
Yes, 73 were recaptured eventually. You know, some of them got right up to the Belgian border and places like that. I mean, fantastic. I tell you what, bloody good show, as some of the letters that we've got from, you know, in our family files say. They just, you know, what a great escape effort. Three made a home run, two to Norway and one to Britain was called the home run. So there's actually five in this particular Gestapo cell, one who was never seen again, and our four were kept together. And another Czech guy, Ivo Tonda, who was the last person to see them alive, and he gave the evidence of what happened to them as far as he knew.
Can you read the order there, from Heinrich Himmler, that was given to the police chief in regards to the execution of these men, please?
Yes. I'm disappointed and indignant about the inefficient security measures. As a deterrent, the Führer has ordered that more than half of the escaped officers to be shot. After interrogation, the officers are to be returned to their original camp and to be shot en route. The shootings will be explained by the fact that the recaptured officers were shot whilst trying to escape or because they offered resistance, so that nothing can be proved later.
Oh, that's chilling. I think in those orders you can really get to kind of like, in a way, the heart of the Nazi evil there, in a way. There's the kind of ruthlessness of the order, and then the bureaucratic nature of it, and then the cowardice. Oh, we'll make it look like they were trying to escape.
Yeah, exactly.
That's really chilling hearing that. So what happened to John?
Well, unfortunately, he was in the big pile, the 50 to be shot, and the last person to see him alive, I've since read his evidence to the War Crimes Commission, was Ivo Tonda, and I've since met his daughter and been to the camp with her and, you know, all of these things through this story. According to Ivo, he saw the group, and of the group, only one, who was John, was absolutely ashen-faced, and he believes that John knew what was going to happen to them and hadn't told the others, because they still expected that they would be returned to the camp. They thought that it was their duty to escape, and, you know, the people had been escaping from camps all over Europe and they kept just being thrown back. So this was a real turning point in the way that they were treating these prisoners. So all we know is that early in the morning they were taken out of the cells. We don't know where to. We don't even know necessarily who by. And then there's just this absolutely devastating evidence given by the crematorium manager from the town called Most, which is the early morning phone call, which is, heat the ovens, we're bringing in the bodies. And, it seems almost ridiculous for me to be choked up about it. It happened in 1944, but it happened to my dad's brother. And it happened in a war where, you know, so many terrible things were happening that to have a clean shot through the heart or the head maybe was considered better. You know, the crematorium manager actually said they were in good condition, as though most of the bodies he got weren't. So this moment to me is almost like a haunting moment where John is returned lifeless with Rusty and with Jersey and with Leslie. And it doesn't matter what you do, how much humour you can find in their short lives and their great careers as flyers and the fun they had in Starlag Luft 3, it's just a really dreadful thing to happen, and it's so unnecessary. And, it's no more tragic than any other person who died in the war, but it's our person, if that makes sense.
There is something particularly devastating about the extermination of someone with ingenuity and talent, isn't there?
But and the deliberate manner in which it occurred. And I think that has made it... I think that's what made it so difficult, particularly for my grandmother, to accept what had happened, because, as my uncle said to me, he said, look, you know, the thing about being a POW is it's almost a relief. When you get the telegram as a mother or as a family, and it's a POW one, not a death one, you're like, oh, thank God, all we have to do is sit out the war. He's down. Okay, there was a certain sense of shame, perhaps, in no longer participating in the war, you know, felt useless, whatever, that's nothing. But you're down and your son will be home safe. Does that make sense? So I think that then the deliberate extermination of his life on the whim of such a, you know, psychotic dictator, really. It was a personal whim of Hitler. It wasn't anything that existed within the rules. This was his personal whim, as the war wasn't going his way. And that's the closing scene, and you just can't make that better.
When the movie came out in the 1960s, did anyone in the family want to see the movie? I mean, what did they think of the movie?
I guess so. I mean, look, because I was young in the 60s, I probably don't have a good enough memory of it. A lot of the people who were truly involved with The Great Escape, the families didn't want to see it, and they had some very negative things to say about it.
How about the execution of those men? How is that dealt with in the film?
Well, the way they do it is there's kind of a silhouette, so they push a few extras out of cars and push them up a hill, tell them to go and urinate because they're, you know, long trip, blah, blah, blah. And then you sort of see the silhouette on the hill, and then they kind of machine gun them. But the key character, Steve McQueen, who did John's bedboard levy and all of that, he rides around on his motorbike, which is completely made up, and, you know,
leaps over the fence,
almost makes it into some faux-looking Switzerland. But then he ends up back in the cooler bouncing his baseball. So he, you know, the hero lives. So some of them did. 23 of them did survive, and 3 got home. So the interesting thing, though, in investigating who was killed and why, the colonials were very disproportionately represented on the list. So all the New Zealanders were killed. Only one Australian was not on the list, and he was an RAF officer. So he may have been thought to be British. So what they did was pick all of the others, the ones that weren't British, who weren't, you know, perhaps in London ordering extra bombing runs on Europe. So again, that's very, to me, very cowardly.
In 2012, the surviving families of those 4 men, including your uncle, met at a memorial in Czechoslovakia?
Czechoslovakia,
Czech Republic. Tell me about that day.
Well, again, this was the sort of culmination of this email from Mikhail, who decided that these men had made it from the camp into the then Czechoslovakia, now the Czech Republic, and had been killed in this way and just forgotten. He decided that it should be remembered, and he was going to spend his own money on this beautiful granite memorial in the gardens, actually near the crematorium, which is a little bit spooky, but anyway. And would we all come? And my first reaction was, oh, I'm far too busy, it's far too... I mean, just ridiculous, silly thing that, you know, I thought, oh, you know, it's expensive, et cetera, et cetera. I thought, oh, my goodness, of course I'm coming. So we made whatever effort we could to get as many members of the family there as we could. So my mum came and my brother and, you know, not everybody. And there we met the Kiratz, Rusty's family, and we met the daughter of Jerzy Monshine, who'd bought the tickets, and she's Polish, and as a child, because Poland was behind the Iron Curtain, she had to pretend her father didn't exist because, you know, the RAF pilots were traitors. And then the niece of Leslie Ball. So it was almost electric, this feeling that somebody, you know, this idea of the kindness of strangers, this idea that someone on the other side of the world would remember just these four men, you know, and there's a beautiful memorial there. And it sort of snowballed because Mikhail started to talk to people about it, and we ended up with a Czech Air Force flypast, which was amazing. And quite to the contrary, it was on the anniversary of the escape. It was an unseasonably warm and brilliant spring, the opposite of that snow. And we had flowers and clear blue sky and these beautiful, you know, these aircraft whooshing through the air and bunches of flowers and wreaths. And it was just like this wonderful antidote.
Louise, it's been so lovely to speak with you. Thank you so much. What an amazing story.
Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.